It is a sacred time, this, and a sacred place, this. It is a place for questions more profound than answers, vulnerability more powerful than strength, and a peace that can pass all understanding. It is a sacred time, this. Let us begin it together in song. In the center of our service, in the center of our lives, let us make room for life's quieter sides. We may use these first moments for lighting candles of memory and hope, or just sitting quietly, remembering who you are and why you are here. Please join me in a spirit of prayer. It matters so much what we choose to worship. Let us not serve gods that are not worth serving. Let us not kiss the hand that hits us, nor forgive those who systematically abuse us, nor worship gods who do not love us. We are surprisingly religious people, whether or not we even think we care about gods. Our biggest religious problem is often the fact that we serve not wisely, but too well. We do what those around us do. We share our friends' assumptions about life, about what's worth spending money on, what's worth sacrificing for, about what sacrifices will lead us toward that heaven on earth known as the good life. Most of the gods we serve with our lives are second-hand gods. We get them from our family and friends, from those we envy or admire. And we often serve them almost without question. We must serve something with our lives. We must serve something that transcends and trumps the day-to-day ordinariness. We will serve gods, whether we recognize them or not. But let us back off a bit and try to recognize the gods we are serving. Let us ask whether they are really worth serving, whether they give us life or just drain it away from us. Let us strive to serve only gods that love us, for it matters so much what we choose to worship. Amen.
This is the start of an unusual set of sermons. It's been a very long time since I've read anything that seemed to make so many clear patterns and connections in important areas as Naomi Klein's new long book, The Shock Doctrine, The Rise of Disaster Capitalism. It's the story of how what she calls a fundamentalist capitalism, and I think that's a good name for it, has been seeking for 60 years to undo the advances of President Roosevelt's New Deal, to transfer wealth and power back where they think they belong, which is to the wealthy and powerful. But mostly I want to look at this story as a theologian rather than as a historian. Religion is always about the gods we're serving, whether we know what they are or not. And honest religion must always ask whether they're worth serving and what we get for serving them, or whether they're being used by the few to enslave the many, as gods usually are. That's really the historical job of gods, it seems, to be rented out to the powerful. For better and worse, our religion, our personal religion, and the religion that we hear in churches is mostly just concerned with our personal questions and issues. That's what troubles us. But not mostly concerned with what St. Paul once called the powers and principalities that run the larger world. It's a wonderful phrase. But those powers and principalities in the background always define some of the rules and the limits for the lives that we can live in the foreground. And the gods being served behind the scenes make the difference between our world today and 50 years ago. After World War II, this was a country in which the laws and the economic priorities favored and empowered the middle class, the class that Aristotle had said 2,400 years ago had to be the empowered class for a democracy to work. Putting it theologically, the gods being served by the New Deal empowered the middle class's economic possibilities and controlled the greed of wealthy and powerful individuals and corporations through taxes, unions, and government regulations. Those are about the only three things that can control that kind of greed: taxes, workers' unions, and government regulations. It was a long time ago. Most women didn't work outside the home then, but the man's one paycheck was enough. The father of one of my boyhood friends drove a milk truck. He delivered, this sounds like another world, and for many of you it would be, he delivered bottles of milk to people's front doorsteps. It's what he did for a living. You wouldn't think he made much money, and he probably didn't. But it was enough to buy a new house in a nice middle-class neighborhood, buy a car, and to send two boys through college. It gave his family very good health insurance, gave him lifelong job security with Anderson and Erickson Milk Company in Des Moines, and it gave him a retirement that let him and his wife spend their final years living in the style to which they had become accustomed since they were in their 20s, their whole life. That's a fair picture of the America that I grew up in, where you could say, if you were going to talk about it in religious terms or biblical terms, you could say that the powers and principalities had been forced to serve the prophets of the Old Testament, the ones who cared for the poor and the vulnerable. Today, different gods are being served, and that has changed our world as it was intended to. And that's part of what this series is about. Today, both partners work in most families, but their combined income buys less than the one paycheck did 40 to 50 years ago. Today, our country has the highest infant mortality rate in the developed world, is the only industrialized country that doesn't provide health insurance to its people, has the lowest standard of living among the industrialized world for its old people, and the most obscene discrepancy, or the greatest, depending on your point of view, in income between the richest and the rest. CEOs average more than 400 times as much as the workers in the same company in this country. And that's a tenfold increase in just the past 30 years. Public education is underfunded and underwhelming. And tax cuts for the rich are taken, as always, from public services to the rest. All of this is a result of the gods we are serving and the result of very intentional, extremely well thought out, and I must say, brilliant plans. In my sermon on living under fascism 3.5 years ago, I linked together plutocracy, the rule of wealth, imperialism, and fascism as necessary allies. I had not thought at all to include things like violence, torture, illegal invasions, and mass murder. But Naomi Klein argues that all these are among the means by which money and power must be taken from the masses who will not give them up willingly. Today, I'll focus not on those means. I'll talk about that next week when we go through the history. of how this has worked. It really is brilliant in a brutal way. But I want to talk today on what she calls fundamentalist capitalism. It's a funny thing to call something economic, and it goes by an amazing list of other names. I have written down a few of the names that I've read for this capitalism. You've read many of them. You may have read many more. Here are about 30 terms. Barbarian capitalism, savage capitalism, that's the French call it that, Reaganomics, Thatcherite, Chicago School economics, the greed is good school, frontier capitalism, gangster capitalism, crony capitalism, free market capitalism, laissez-faire capitalism, disaster capitalism, economic shock therapy, that's a term Milton Friedman created for it, hollow government shrunk to a size that can be drowned in the bathtub. You know that quote from Grover Norquist? What that means, shrinking the government means removing all possible services that educate, empower, and protect the middle and lower classes. That's what it means to shrink the government. Plutocracy, neoliberalism, neoconservatism, globalization, an entrepreneur's utopia that exalts profits over people, owners over workers, and corporations over governments, yes, and economic fascism. What all of these really strange names have in common behind the economic theories they're pointing to is the same guiding economic theory and the same guiding figure, Milton Friedman. The larger history of all this, though, is very old. For all of history, there has been a battle. This cannot be a surprise to any of us. There's been a battle for power between the few and the power for the many, between the haves and the have-nots. And if you have, you certainly want to have power, too. Since money buys a lot more power than poverty does, that can't be a surprise. Power mostly serves those with money rather than those without it. The battle certainly goes back to the founding of our own country when it was argued very forcefully and not in shy ways. Alexander Hamilton declared that the people, the masses, are a great beast that must be tamed. John Jay, the first Chief Justice of our Supreme Court, said, "The people who own the country ought to govern it." The primary responsibility of government is to protect the minority of the opulent against the majority, said James Madison. Without property or the hope of acquiring it, people cannot be expected to sympathize sufficiently with its rights. His solution was to keep political power in the hands of those who come from and represent the wealth of the nation, the more capable set of men. These aren't subtle statements. Madison, to his credit, soon learned differently. As the opulent minority began living by the motto, "All for ourselves and nothing for other people," that almost never happens. By 1792, Madison warned that the rising, developing capitalist state was substituting the motive of private interest in place of public duty, leading to a real domination by the few under a merely apparent liberty of the many. This doesn't sound alien to us. Thomas Jefferson also distrusted the emerging class of capitalists. "The selfish spirit of commerce knows no country and feels no passion or principle but that of gain," he wrote. This sounds surprisingly modern, doesn't it? Today we have unleashed, in many people's opinions, we have unleashed that selfish spirit on nearly the whole world under the name globalization and all the other more colorful names by which it is known. But this battle between the rich and the rest has gone on forever. The last great victory for the rest, for the middle class in our country, came with President Franklin Delano Roosevelt. In a 1932 speech during the height of the Depression, Roosevelt addressed the problems of the Depression by telling the American people, in a line that became quite famous, that I pledge to you, I pledge to myself, a new deal for the American people. That new deal that Roosevelt promised began to take shape immediately after his inauguration in 1933. Based on his assumption that the power of the federal government was needed to get the country out of the Depression, it's the opposite of the attitude toward the power of the government today. Notice, the first days of Roosevelt's administration saw the passage of banking reform laws, emergency relief programs, work relief programs, and agricultural programs. Later, a second New Deal was to evolve, and it included union protection programs, the Social Security Act, and programs to aid tenant farmers and migrant workers. What was new about the New Deal was that it served the masses rather than the masters, for which many people hated Roosevelt. In the short term, New Deal programs helped improve the lives of people suffering from the events of the Depression. In the long run, the New Deal program set a precedent for the federal government to play a key role in the economic and social affairs of the nation, to rescue it from the fairly unrestrained greed of the robber baron and the Gilded Age, whose excesses had led to the Depression in the 20s and 30s. The reforms of the New Deal were what enabled my friend's father to support his family on the pay of a milkman and enabled a whole generation of the American middle class to become educated, financially stable, and empowered as full citizens of our country for the first time in two or three generations. The powers and principalities were forced to serve new gods, and many of them hated it. They said that Roosevelt had betrayed his class by letting the poor come up for air. And they began planning how to get all the money and power back in the hands of that opulent minority, that better class of men that Madison had imagined. Now, in the 1950s, it was very hard to talk openly in polite society, maybe impossible, about returning to an era of unrestrained greed that just doesn't spin well. But behind the scenes, a lot was going on. It was very far-sighted, and it was brilliant. And at the time, it didn't focus so much on our country, since we were unfortunately saddled with the costs of the New Deal and empowering a middle class. It focused on the rest of the world, especially South America. Why? Because after World War II, our country was seeking global economic dominance in what we saw as a life or death struggle against communism. Communism, in economic terms, is known as a liberal, our far left economy, since the government owns most of the lucrative assets rather than wealthy corporations or individuals. American capitalism took the other path. But in the four countries at the tip of South America, known as the Southern Cone, a third path had been found, which seemed to work better and empowered governments and the people, though not wealthy industrialists and bankers. Chile, for example, had been a democracy for about a century and a half. And it began to look like Chile, Argentina, Uruguay, and parts of Brazil might have a better economic plan than either the Soviet Union or the United States. This is part of what was going on behind the scenes. The workers in their factories formed powerful unions that negotiated middle-class salaries, and their children were sent off to study at newly built public universities. The gap between rich and poor began to narrow. By the 1950s, Argentina had the largest middle class on the continent, and Uruguay had a literacy rate of 95% and offered free health care for all citizens. Now, think about this if you're on the other side and see what a danger it is. If other countries followed this model, then this third way between the government control of communism and the unregulated greed of laissez-faire capitalism, or the control of private owners and corporations, this third way could become the path of the future. This would disempower the very corporations and bankers who had once controlled our government and who wanted to regain that control. Worldwide, trillions of dollars were at stake. It was the biggest game on the planet. It just wasn't publicized much. What the capitalists needed, and you can think with them on the plans they need to see how brilliant this was, because it was brilliant. What they really needed, no matter how fantastic it sounds, they needed a long-range plan to change the economic thinking of people in these South American countries. That's hard to do since what they were doing there worked. Ideally, still in the realm of fantasy here, ideally, they would have all the economists trained at the University of Chicago School of Economics, because it was the most right-wing corporatist school of economics in the world. And very few people know that that's exactly what they did. Officially launched in 1956, the project saw 100 students from Chile pursue advanced degrees at the University of Chicago School of Economics between 1957 and 1970. Their tuition and expenses paid for by U.S. taxpayers and U.S. foundations. In 1965, the program was expanded to include students from across Latin America, with particularly heavy participation from Argentina, Brazil, and Mexico. The expansion was funded through a grant from the Ford Foundation and led to the creation of the Center for Latin American Economic Studies at the University of Chicago. I remember that word when I was there. I just didn't know what it meant. Under the program, there were 40 to 50 Latin American students studying graduate-level economics at any given time. In other words, about one-third of the economics department's total students. By comparison, at Harvard or MIT, there were just four or five Latin American students. In just a decade, the ultra-conservative University of Chicago had become the premier destination for Latin Americans wanting to study economics, a fact that would shape the course of the region's history, or the world's history, for decades to come. It's a fascinating story, and they were thinking so far ahead. But think of this activity as missionary activity, as religious zealots paying missionaries to go to foreign countries and convert the natives, but this time with trillions of dollars at stake. The religious analogy is not far-fetched or unfair. Milton Friedman, the high priest of this fundamentalist capitalism, described himself once as an old-fashioned preacher delivering a Sunday sermon. He was about conversion. His evangelical mission and the mission of the Chicago School of Economics was about converting the natives of South America to undo all the gains of the New Deal in our own country and to reestablish an economy that gave money and power back where they belonged, to the corporations and the very wealthy, so that those who owned the world could run it. Today, many believe their victory is nearly complete. Like all fundamentalisms, like all certainties, there was a blindness to this that was just stunning. In the 1990s, for example, and I'll talk more about this next week, Friedman looked back on Pinochet's entire reign in Chile. Chile was the first place Friedman got to try his theories out with full force in 1973. In the 1990s, he looked back on Pinochet's entire reign. 17 years of dictatorship, tens of thousands of people tortured, murdered, and Friedman saw it not as a violent unmaking of democracy. Remember, Chile by then had been a democracy for 161 years, the last 41 years without interruption. What Friedman said instead was, the really important thing about the Chilean business is that free markets did work their way in bringing about a free society. It's not true. It isn't what happened. Pinochet's brutality closed the free society and ended 161 years of democracy, tortured, murdered, or intimidated those who disagreed, and made Pinochet and his family very wealthy at the expense of the overwhelming majority of Chileans who have not recovered yet. Even in 1991, Lawrence Summers, another high priest, the chief economist of the World Bank, was quoted as saying, you can imagine a preacher, an evangelical preacher saying this, spread the truth. The laws of economics are like the laws of engineering. One set of laws works everywhere. That kind of dogmatic certainty, and it's powerful, can't be used until you've answered some very basic pre-economic questions, like, who counts more, owners or workers? Those who own stocks or those who don't? How do you measure whether an economy is healthy? By the poverty rate, the number of uninsured citizens, literacy rates, infant mortality, the prospects for middle class advancement and security, whether milkmen can support their families, or by the net worth of the top 5%. How do you define a healthy economy? If a few become very wealthy while the vast majority become destitute and powerless, is that a good thing or a bad thing? If you go to Sao Paulo in Brazil and see some rich, gleaming skyscrapers and hundreds of mansions surrounded by millions of poor people in drug and crime-infested ghettos, is the economy a success or a failure? And does the answer depend on where you live? And what if you make the same observations in our own country? These are the pre-economic questions that determine everything. Lawrence Summers could be dogmatic because, like others in the Chicago School, he had answered those questions in favor of the corporations and the very wealthy and against the interests of 90 to 95% of the world. But those answers to the questions of who is to be empowered and what makes a healthy economy are more important than everything else that follows, because they show what gods are being served by a country and by the powers and principalities. It's an amazing blindness, but it is not unique. It's virtually identical to that found in the history of religions, and you can think of many examples of this. I'll give you just a couple. During the Crusades, the Catholic Church saw only taking land and assets from those heretical Muslim people. They didn't see the systematic torture and slaughter of hundreds of thousands of God's children. During the Inquisition, the same church was completely oblivious to the brutality of the torture they routinely inflicted on thousands, or the many they murdered in the name of keeping their faith pure by exterminating those who did not share it. One of the most famous books from that area is called The Witch's Hammer, which was a manual of methods of torture used for centuries. It was only really improved on in the 1950s and 60s through help from the CIA and some psychologists and military. We'll talk about that next week. Every major religion has these dark sides to their dogmatic certainty, as fundamentalist capitalism also does. And in the past 35 years, this form of capitalism, shaped by Milton Friedman, has fundamentally changed our country and our world. Now, you can see how easy it is to get very self-righteous here, to shake our moral fingers at the church or at those damned rich people, identifying them as spawn of the devil from our perch of moral purity. I don't want us to do that. While we're not in those very high circles of money or power, we can identify with this thinking that our sort of inequality should be favored. So I want to convict us a little on this. If we have more education than others, or from more prestigious schools, we think it should make a difference, don't we? We think that superstar athletes and entertainers certainly deserve much more money than all the rest. If we think we're good looking, then we think looks should matter, don't we? Whereas, if we're smarter than we are beautiful, we think looks are superficial and overrated. I think almost without exception, when the rights and privileges of inequality favor us, we favor them. So it shouldn't surprise us if those who are good at collecting money and power are doing the same thing, favoring the inequality that favors them and wanting restrictions on it removed. Wouldn't most of us do the same? It is so easy to rationalize. A couple new cars and a mansion would do the trick for most of us. We serve many different gods, and the gods we serve determine almost everything about our lives and our world. That's why I think religion is one of the most important disciplines in life. If we're challenged, we will usually insist that our gods are our own business, and of course, they're good and the right ones. But is it really just our business? Do we really have no responsibility to others in choosing what we will serve? Should a society have no say in the gods, the ideals served by its powers and principalities? These are not just political or social questions. They are profoundly religious questions. They're theological questions. Next week, I'll continue this by going through the results of this powerful economic theory, and it really has been powerful and in its way brilliant. And I'll talk about the methods necessary to achieve the revolution from 1973 to present and how it's evolved. The short answer is that nearly all the violence, all the torture, all the coups, and all the human rights violations since the early 1970s, at least, have been driven by this fundamentalist capitalism, which Naomi Klein argues has never made the world better anywhere, but has caused almost immeasurable harm as it continues to do to this day. Again, these are religious questions about the gods being served by the powers and principalities that govern our world. They affect us all. It's popular to talk about dead gods and living gods. These are living gods. They're wreaking their havoc right now in your credit card debt, your diminished purchasing power, your sense of job security, your retirement hopes. We've come a long way from the days when a milkman could buy a new house, support a family, and send two sons through college by delivering milk bottles to the doors. Do you like these new gods? Do you think they're worth serving? How do you fire gods? Here we're left in an awkward picture with our gods dangling. But think about this week, about the gods you're serving, won't you? The gods, the values running your life and your country. Think about whether they're worth serving, whether they love you, whether they're empowering you, whether they're giving you life or giving you grief. And then that odd question, how do you fire bad gods?